NPR in Washington, D.C.
and NPR West in Los Angeles, this is Intern Edition. I'm Erin Marie Williams.
And I'm Sean Bowditch. Today we go straight to the ballots to learn how the Republican Party hopes to gain momentum with more African-American voters.
And forget those dreams of med school. One man's pastime led him to a career in online poker.
Plus, we visit a Los Angeles culinary school where cookbooks get pushed to the back burner.
Then, students get schooled in the art of zombie walking.
1 and 2 points.
One man's fascination with Michael Jackson's Thriller.
And this semester's crop of interns went green, first with a charity bake sale for DC Greenworks, a local nonprofit specializing in green roofing.
We'll also talk to Jason Mullenix, whose business aims to keep the environment and your house clean. Stay tuned for these stories and more.
This is Intern Edition. The news is next.
For Intern Edition News, I'm Fiona Zublin. The 8 candidates vying for the Republican presidential nomination gathered on Wednesday night to answer questions submitted through YouTube.com and CNN. With 5 weeks until the Iowa caucuses, the candidates discussed immigration, the national debt, and gun control. Intern Edition's Elliot Ward has more.
The biggest fireworks came early. The first question had Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani vying for the title of toughest on immigration. Romney called New York a sanctuary city. Giuliani fired right back.
The illegal immigrants who were working at his mansion. So I would say he had sanctuary mansion, not just sanctuary city.
A heated back and forth ensued.
Mayor, you know better than that.
No, I...
Yeah, okay, then listen, all right? Then listen.
You did.
First of all...
You did have illegal immigrants working at your mansion, didn't you?
No, I did not.
On the question of Iraq, all the candidates except Ron Paul advocated staying the course with no timetable for withdrawal. For Intern Edition News, I'm Elliot Ward.
A day after stepping down from the military, Pakistan's president was sworn into office as a civilian. Andrew Prince has the story.
Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf was sworn in for a new 5-year term today, this time as a civilian president. His inauguration ceremony was held one day after he quit his 4-decade military career. Musharraf said the country would be stronger with him serving as a civilian, and he called the transition a milestone for Pakistan. The military has traditionally been a powerful political force in the country. Facing criticism, Musharraf defended the emergency rule that began on November 3rd when he suspended the Constitution and purged the Supreme Court. He called his actions, quote, extraordinary but necessary. National elections are scheduled for January 8th, but opposition members have threatened a boycott to protest the emergency order. For Intern Edition News, I'm Andrew Prince.
In Manila today, government forces quelled an impromptu coup attempt by dissident soldiers. Around 2 dozen renegade soldiers took over a luxury hotel after walking out on their own trial for their participation in an attempted coup in 2003. From the hotel, the rebels called for the overthrow of Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo before police battered down the barricaded entrance. The rebels then surrendered. According to police reports, at least 2 people were injured. The curtain rises on Broadway tonight after weeks of a crippling strike. Asma Khalid has more.
After 19 days of darkness, Broadway lights will shine again tonight. Theater producers and Broadway stagehands agreed to a provisionary 5-year contract late Wednesday night.
We are pleased to announce that we have a tentative agreement ending the Broadway strike.
Charlotte St. Martin, director of the League of American Theaters and Producers, said the agreement was a good compromise for the industry, but neither side released details of the settlement. The strike has cost New York City an estimated $2 million a day. It was the longest Broadway strike since 1975. For Intern Edition News, I'm Asma Khalid.
This is Intern Edition News.
Listening to Intern Edition. The Iraq War may seem an unlikely source for musical inspiration, but for a group of former soldiers, it's been just that. They've joined together to form a recording label called To the Fallen Records. Elliot Ward has more.
Cliff Hudson started playing guitar in college. He was passionate about playing, even after graduating and enlisting in the Marine Corps. While serving in Iraq in 2005, his father-in-law sent him the perfect care package.
He had heard somewhere that another guy had bagpipes, and he said, well, if that guy can have bagpipes, then my future son-in-law can most certainly have a guitar to take over there. And I did not realize how much I had longed to be able to play guitar and to write music and do things like that until I actually had the smell of the cedar and could feel the six strings on my fingertips.
Cliff's guitar became a rallying point and a source of much-needed distraction for his fellow soldiers.
We'd play stuff and just take requests, and 9 times out of 10 it turned into guys making up little songs to berate one another with and just kind of sit there and have a little relaxation, a comical moment out of the stress of the day.
Josh Rivak, another soldier, turned to music for a different kind of therapy. He used it to mourn. Just 2 weeks into his first deployment, one of his good friends, Timothy Haslett, was killed by a roadside bomb.
It was just a blow, a hard blow, and the guitar's always been there for me, you know, when nobody else was. It was all I knew how to do. It was almost like a reflex.
Josh wrote a song for his friend and played it at his memorial. Everyone was touched. So much that Josh was asked to play at the next memorial and the next.
It wasn't just another Army event where you just sit at attention and choke your way through it. It was more like an outlet, like I believe it's supposed to be.
Called your name again, so I can't pretend that you're not gone.
In June 2006, Josh was wounded. Sitting in the hospital, thinking of his fallen friends, he wrote the song Empty Boots.
Let your voice be heard, every silent word you say.
Many artists on the To the Fallen Records label say the power of their music has little to do with skill. For Cliff and Josh, their guiding principle is a simple one: 3 chords and the truth. Cliff explains.
You can know all the chords and know all the riffs and know all the jams and be able to play and everything, and that's fine. But when it all comes down to it, 3 chords and the truth is really all you need.
This simple approach makes the music evocative for any listener. In fact, Rivak says it can help people understand what it's like on the front lines.
People want to be able to relate. They want to be able to empathize. They don't know what to do when they see soldiers who have experienced these horrible things. And music has been huge to people. It's told them a story where a conversation wouldn't. It speaks from the heart.
Sometimes their hearts break, but they've just got to carry on.
It was the sacrifice and dedication of his fellow soldiers that led Chad Van Rice to write this song, The Veterans. It also inspired him to sign up for 3 tours in Iraq. For Intern Edition, I'm Elliot Ward.
And for all the things.
A compilation CD featuring these artists will be released December 4th.
Not many African Americans identify as Republicans. That's despite the rise of high-profile GOPers like Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. Today, the party is working to rebuild the numbers of this key demographic. Intern Edition's Will Wright reports.
Near Capitol Hill, the D.C. Young Republicans meet for happy hour. This multicolored, multicultural group is gathered at Bullfeather's cozy bar talking about work on the Hill or their plans to get there. Marcus Skelton is chatting with other attendees. He chairs the D.C. Young Republicans, directing minority outreach programs for the Young Republican National Federation. He thinks their recruiting efforts are doing well, but sees room for improvement.
Oh, I think we have a long way to go, and I think one of the most important things we have to do is ask, and ask more people of color to be involved in the party.
But according to Alex St. James of the African American Republican Leadership Council, it takes more than politely asking or patiently waiting to be invited.
Don't wait for the party to come knocking on your door. That hasn't been our history. They didn't let us in at the restaurant, and if we had stayed outside, we still would not be sitting at the counter. We have to get in there and kick the door in.
Kicking in that door? To be able to sit at that counter? That's language hearkening back to the civil rights era of the 1960s. Devoted African American Republicans, like St. James, point out that the party dates back to long before then. They say it started in the Reconstruction era of the 1860s, when the party was the political home for former slaves.
And so sometimes when I'm at functions and I run into my fellow white Republicans and they say, oh, it's nice to see you here with us. And I'm saying, oh, let's get this straight, actually. It's nice to see you've joined us. The party was actually started because of me, not you, so I'm glad you're on board.
Getting African Americans on board is Shannon Reeves' job. He runs the GOP's outreach effort to increase African American membership. When he leaves Republican functions and goes into the black community, he hears a different message.
You catch hell being black and Republican. And that's just the fact. I mean, you know, you go into the barbershop, and I grew up in the barbershop in Oakland, California, and I walk into the barbershop, and they say, here comes Baby Bush, you know. But they talk about me at church. You have to defend it at the family reunion.
Reeves has been traveling across the U.S., from north to south, east to west. He's building a national network of African-American state party groups under the party's umbrella. Reeves says it's not just Democrats who care for values and issues important to African-Americans.
Education's real important, and others it's about economic empowerment, others are on social issues and family values, and we're able to bring all that together and say at the same time we have some major ills in the African American community, and that African Americans in the Republican Party need to be at the forefront of having that conversation.
Reeves claims those issues make it relatively easy to attract African Americans to the party. Michael Fauntroy is public policy professor at George Mason University. He disagrees.
If it were that easy, then you'd have more than just a handful of African Americans running for Congress or Senate or governor around the country in every election cycle.
Back at Bullfeathers, the D.C. Young Republicans are optimistic. Recent college graduate Sean Connor thinks our current administration has made progress.
This president was the first to really offer cabinet-level positions of importance to people of color. We look at Labor Secretary Cho, if we look at Secretary Rice, if we look at Secretary Page, for example. So there have been a lot of opportunities. I think there still are a lot of opportunities to increase it when we look at campaign side, at strategist side, you know, think tank sides. So we have some work to do.
According to the Republicans for Black Empowerment, at least a dozen African Americans plan to run as Republicans on various levels in 2008. This is Will Wright for Intern Edition.
Joining us now is Jason Mullinex. He is the co-owner of Little Green Men, an environmentally friendly cleaning service in Washington, D.C. He spoke with us by phone about his budding new business. Your company is called Little Green Men, and for most of us that brings to mind crop circles. But we're not talking about aliens. What are we talking about here?
We were trying to come up with a catchy name for the business, and we decided Little Green Men was appropriate because we're a small company, green because we're environmentally friendly, and men because it was just me and another guy named Spencer Madsen, so we're just two guys.
When I think of cleaners, I think of Molly Maids. How's that feel, an all-male cleaning staff? Is it all-male?
No, actually our new employee is a female, and a lot of people joked with us about that and said that we can't be Little Green Men anymore, we have to be Little Green Persons. So.
What is green cleaning? What does that mean?
From what my understanding, there's no real government regulations on what it means to be green. But, you know, we're kind of setting our own standards, and we're trying to use non-toxic chemicals, and we're using rags instead of paper products, and trying to organize our day so that we're minimize our drive time. For us, it's all about low impact.
What kind of products do you guys use?
We actually make some of our own. For glass, for instance, we use distilled white vinegar and water, which works wonderfully.
How is green cleaning different than what I do at home?
Well, what do you use at home? I guess that's the question. What's under your cabinet? Like, if I was to open up your, under your sink, what would be there?
Probably bleach, ammonia.
Right. Well, with green cleaning, I think the goal is the same. You want a clean house, but we try to do it a little differently. We use things that, you know, if your dog licks the floor afterwards, he's not going to get sick.
So my infant, were I to have one, could lick my floor
mm-hmm.
safely. How do you guys compare cost-wise?
I think we're comparable. I mean, we might be a slightly more expensive than other places, but we try to be competitive.
Would you say that your clients are more concerned with the green aspect of it or just with the clean?
I think we have some people who just want a clean house and they really don't care how it's done, but I do think that there are people who sought us out specifically because we are green cleaners.
What's the nastiest thing you found in someone's house?
A bloody handprint on the wall.
Can you explain that one to me?
I wish I could.
Do you have a non-disclosure policy?
Yeah. I don't think many people would appreciate, well, guess what I found at so-and-so's house?
It's like client cleaner privilege.
Right. So, I mean, you're coming into somebody's space, so I try to be respectful.
Yeah. What's on your iPod when you're cleaning?
Oh, actually, we typically don't listen to music. We do have one client who has a Pat Benatar tape, so we'll blast that when we clean her house, but otherwise we just kind of do our thing.
I have this great mental image of you cleaning, two men cleaning, listening to Pat Benatar.
Oh, it's great. We rock out the Love is a Battlefield and Hell is for Children and Hit Me with Your Best Shot, and then we'll be singing it the rest of the day. It's pretty cool.
Wow. Jason, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
This is Intern Edition.
The black and white photography of Graciela Iturbide has been shown around the world, from San Francisco to Dusseldorf. But if you've never heard of her, you're not alone. Latinos might be the fastest growing minority group in the U.S., but Latino artists often get lost in the crowd. Sarah Richards explains why.
The picture is called Nuestra Señora a las Iguanas. There's a woman standing in a busy market with four iguanas on her head. She's standing proudly, eyes wide open, her square face weathered. The woman, named Areta, has sewn the iguana's mouth shut so they won't bite. She's selling them. Where she's from, iguanas are a delicacy, and they are resting on her head like a crown. The photograph is from the collection Juchitan by Graciela Iturbide, one of the most acclaimed Mexican photographers of her generation. She photographs mothers and children, young lovers, alleyways, and landscapes. She recently spoke about the inspiration for this work at a photography festival in Rome.
Little by little, it came to me because I was taking a lot of portraits of travesties, of people in the street, lots of landscapes, everything. Everything I could photograph from Rome.
Keller says that though Iturbide's presence is small nationally, she's more well-known in art circles in California.
In terms of the art market, Latin American photography does not have a very big presence in general, and Graciela is one of the few people who is occasionally shown and sold.
Iturbide lives in Coyoacán, a borough of Mexico City, just blocks from the former family home and museum of another Mexican artist, Frida Kahlo. When Kahlo was alive and painting in that house, Mexico City was a cultural hotspot. Images of exotic people and places attracted the attention of artists around the world, including photographer Edward Weston and his partner, Tina Modotti. But after the 1940s, American interest began to cool. Despite the popularity of the Chicano movement in the 70s, many museums today have small Latin American collections. One reason, according to Keller, not enough interested curators.
Even if they had collections of Latin American work, mostly through gifts, they didn't have curators to work with who wanted to get those collections out or to add to them.
Dr. Susan Sterling agrees. She's curating an exhibit called WAC at the National Museum of Women in the Arts.
It takes the passion of a curator to instill that interest in Latin American art into their institution. But there has to be a curator who understands the region and has the passion for that work.
The exhibit explores the history of feminist art. Though Iturbide is not represented, Sterling's mission as a curator is clear.
We think about how we're representing women artists across the globe. And I have a particular interest as a curator in art from Latin America. And I like to look at artists from Canada all the way down to the tip of Argentina to make sure that they have a place here at the museum.
It takes curators like Keller and Sterling to make a place for artists like Graciela Iturbide. And in time, maybe we will all recognize that image of Areta, crowned with iguanas. I'm Sarah Richards for Intern Edition.
In downtown Los Angeles, Monica Ratti's cooking classes have one simple rule: no recipes. Her culinary school prides itself in graduating creative cooks who've thrown away their measuring cups and tablespoons. Intern Edition's Carolyn Silvera followed her nose to one of Ratti's workshops.
Monica Ratti is chopping herbs and answering phone calls at Hip Cooks. The school is housed in an old brewery complex that's now an artist colony in downtown Los Angeles. When students walk through the door, they're more likely to get a glass of wine than a recipe book.
You'll notice today we're not going to use any measuring cups and no recipes.
What?
They're boring. They're somebody else's idea of how to create something.
Today, Retti's teaching a dim sum workshop. She encourages her students to taste and smell the ingredients as they go. No cups or teaspoons allowed.
What I wanted to do was kind of pass it around at the stage of spiciness. And now I'd like for you to smell for salt. Can you smell for salt?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
The test kitchen for her techniques, however, was the London School of Economics. Yes, in a former life, Retty was an economist by day and a chef by night.
That was crazy because I would be at school or at work doing economics until about 4 in the afternoon. I made arrangements with my boss to leave so that I could be at the restaurant by 5, and I'd stay there till 11 or 12 at night cooking. But for me, like those were the best times of my life. My favorite place to be is in the kitchen.
Retty's class is lively. Students laugh and listen to music as they learn. She teaches that the senses rule. And she says, spices aren't just for flavor.
Ginger, use in copious handfuls. This is so good for you. Why? It stimulates qi in the body, so it's used a lot in Chinese medicine, considered an aphrodisiac.
She's right. One young couple taking the class kiss and canoodle all morning. But nobody seems distracted because Retty herself never stops moving. She's fun, but she's also a focused businesswoman planning to expand the school to 5 other cities in 5 years. The result is one sharp woman who can make a 3-hour class go by in a flash.
Basically, with this pan, I wanted to show you guys how to pan flip because it's just a fun thing to do. You actually tilt the pan away from you first, do a little shimmy. Non-pan hand goes behind your back. You're fencing. Do that again. En gueule.
And that energy is what students like Teresa appreciate about the class.
You know what, I was looking for a cooking class to take, and I wanted something that was kind of fun. Like, I found a lot of, like, serious classes, like, you know, white apron and the checked pants, and, you know, you have to take this whole course.
Students leave Hip Cooks eager to test their cooking skills by getting creative in their own kitchens. They want to share this excitement with their friends, so the communal cooking style of the class is just right.
You could sort of incorporate it as part of a nice little dinner party kind of thing. Everybody would have something to do. And then you don't feel like you're just standing there like with your thumb in your ear going, what am I doing?
When Retty's dim sum class has gobbled up the last dumplings, they clear the table and hang up their aprons. As they file out into the sunlight, satiated and enlightened, Retty is wiping down her cooking station and setting up for the afternoon class. For Intern Edition, I'm Carolyn Silvera.
Give me some more. Don't ask what for.
This is Intern Edition.
What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, unless gambling becomes your 9-to-5 job. Elliot Hannon explores what happens when playing online poker starts raking in the dough.
It's just after 9 on a Tuesday night, and Chris Wilson looks ready for bed. He's stripped down to a t-shirt, baggy shorts, and white socks. But instead of calling it a night, he slides his 6-foot-7-inch frame behind his desk, and with a few clicks of the mouse, he goes to work. Only, at 26 years old, this isn't the job he had in mind.
I don't know. I guess I've always planned to go into medicine from the time I was little through, really, up until about 2 years ago.
That's when Wilson got swept up in the party poker craze. He was getting his master's degree at the time, and what began as entertainment soon started to pay the rent and eventually became his full-time job. And he's not alone. Wilson estimates that up to 250,000 people may be betting online at the same time.
It's kind of like the golden handcuffs, and the hourly rate they make from playing it is just too high to get away from, even though they don't enjoy playing anymore. But I still enjoy playing. And if it ever got to the point where I didn't, I would stop.
His eyes dart back and forth as he plays 4 hands at once. But this is only half speed. Wilson can manage as many as 8 at a time.
Okay, so in this hand right now, the pot is $400. And
after thousands of hands, he says playing the right card in every situation becomes second nature.
It's pretty much on autopilot, so the only thing that's really holding me back is how fast I can click the mouse.
Wilson's strategy is simple. Make the best statistical play more often than the other guy. The more you play over a period of time, the higher your odds of coming out on top. He says that this year alone, he's played over 200,000 hands.
And it takes about that many hands to, like, actually, for your results to actually really mean anything. Less than that, and luck just influences too much.
Pointing to a graph of his earnings for the year that peaks in the six figures, Wilson says winning was easier than he thought, but there were unexpected challenges. Tracking his winnings, itemizing business expenses, and writing checks to interest groups that lobby for the online poker industry. He says it's not as glamorous as Hollywood makes it out to be.
It's just a grind, just like everything else. It's a job.
Even for those that don't make a living gambling online and view it simply as entertainment, there are risks involved. The National Council on Problem Gambling reports that between 4 and 8 million Americans have gambling habits that damage their careers and personal lives. For Wilson, the biggest drawback to his unintended profession is coping with a solitary lifestyle.
It's dinner time.
It's almost 11 when he first takes his eyes off the screen.
Stuffed chicken breast from Whole Foods. Pretty sophisticated. It's not all delivery pizza for all poker players.
Wilson plays until the early hours of the morning. There's not much opportunity for water cooler conversation. And even for the most profitable player, it can lead to boredom.
There are a lot of things that it leaves to be desired in terms of a career and stuff like that. I can't really see myself sitting here grinding these tables in 15 years from now or something like that.
Although online poker may not be part of his career plan, those golden handcuffs could help Wilson foot the bill for med school. For Intern Edition, I'm Elliot Hannon.
Parents always tell their kids not to talk to strangers, so inviting one to crash on your couch for a week is likely out of the question. But thousands of people around the world are using the web to do just that. Fiona Zublin takes a closer look.
Nina Dobrat is a 21-year-old college student from Knoxville, Tennessee. 3 days ago, she made plans to visit the nation's capital.
I decided to go to Washington, D.C., bought a ticket to go to Washington, D.C., and then joined couchsurfing.com all like within the same 2 hours.
She logged on to couchsurfing.com, a free online network connecting travelers from Washington, D.C. to Indonesia and all points in between. Members post profiles that travelers can browse to find free places to stay all over the world. When you find a good couch, you send an email.
Jeffrey was the first to respond with a yes. And so I was like, okay, it's fate. And then here we are.
Nina's host, Jeffrey Platts, has been a member of the Couchsurfing Project since it launched in 2004. He lives in a small, cozy apartment in central Washington, and he owns what he and Nina agree is the most comfortable couch in the world. Jeffrey says that hosts help couch surfers navigate an unfamiliar city.
You definitely learn the city better. Just, you know, where's the best coffee shop to go to? Where's the place if you want vegetarian food? Where's the place if you want to go take a yoga class? That's the cool thing, just really getting an insider's view of the city.
Dan Hoffer is one of the founders of the Couchsurfing Project. He says that even though a stranger's couch may not be as comfortable as a hotel bed, it has its advantages, like building relationships.
It's a chance to, first of all, make a new friend, but then also really get a sense of how people live in different areas and how different cultures function.
Despite what may seem like noble motives, sometimes it's hard to explain why you'd be willing to stay with a stranger. Donna Renee is from Oregon. She says she trusts the site, but because she's not sure how others will react, she keeps her couch surfing life under wraps.
I haven't told too many people because I thought, they'll think I'm crazy, that I'm going to get murdered in the middle of the night by a serial killer. How can you possibly stay at a stranger's house? What are you thinking? Or how could you possibly have a stranger over? That's just nuts.
Anytime you stay with strangers, there's the possibility of something bad happening. But according to statistics on the site, less than 0.1% of couch surfing interactions are negative. Hoffer says the success of Couchsurfing.com indicates that it might be okay to trust strangers again.
I think the members of the Couchsurfing community are idealistic and believe in the goodness of others. There's a lot of conflict in this world and a lot of distrust, and Couchsurfing, many of our members feel, is sort of a beacon of light that encourages people to trust strangers and reach out to each other.
After her restful weekend on Platt's couch, Nina Dobratz is ready to reach out and open her house to other couchsurfers. She's already received a request from a guy motorcycling from Pennsylvania to California. For Intern Edition, I'm Fiona Zublin.
Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world. Don't be afraid to try the greatest sport around. Catch a wave, catch a wave.
When you think of an athlete, names like Michael Jordan and Tom Brady may come to mind. But what about a bowler or a golfer? Are they any less athletic because they don't run or jump for a living? Kate Brandley explores this question.
When most people think of athletes, they might agree with ESPN contributor Nick Stevens.
Do you swing a golf club? Do you skate on the ice? Do you tackle another 275-pound man-beast? You're an athlete.
But what about people like Mary Whipple or Pete Cipollone? Are they athletes?
Here we go, send! Half breed, three-quarter building!
Mary Whipple and Pete Cipollone are both medalists for past U.S. Olympic rowing teams, but they didn't row. They're coxswains, the little people sitting in the boat, guiding their team down the course.
Seven!
They don't get credit for winning a race, but they can get the blame for losing it. With 18 years of coaching under his belt, Matt Madigan understands the coxswain's importance.
You're relying on that coxswain to get your crew where they need to be, to get them to do what they need to do, to motivate the crew, and on top of it all, to steer a straight course.
That relationship doesn't work if the rowers don't trust their coxswain.
Have you ever gotten into a car as a passenger and someone's driving this car and you are just petrified? You know, now, the person driving the car, maybe they're perfectly fine, but you don't have the confidence in that.
That's Mike Teddy, the U.S. men's rowing coach. He says that a skilled coxswain must make decisions quickly, without panicking.
It's like being a race car driver or a jockey. You're riding this horse, and you're at your pace. You got to get around this crowd in front of you. Do you go around the crowd? Do you try to go through it? You know, or when do you make your move?
Mary Whipple makes those kinds of decisions. She's the coxswain for the U.S. women's team. Whipple says although coxswains aren't always viewed as athletes, they're still essential members of the team.
I am their teammate, and I'll do anything for them, and they know that, and that's what makes me valuable in the boat.
Pete Cipollone is a former U.S. men's coxswain. Differences off the water make him question whether he measures up as an athlete. He and his teammates were once approached by a curious couple who asked,
"What kind of team are you? You know, because there are these eight huge guys and me." And so the five-man said, "Oh, we're a dwarf-chucking team. We brought our own dwarf."
But for Whipple, there's that one reassuring moment that reminds her she's a worthy competitor. On the podium with her team after placing in a race.
As soon as they put that silver medal and it hit my stomach, it felt like no other medal. It was just heavy, and that was when it clicked, like, oh my gosh, I just won an Olympic medal.
Cipollone, who took home the gold in 2004, says the medal may not make him an athlete, but it lets him know where he stands in the rowing world.
The race, the minutes afterwards, getting out on the dock to get our medals, those images and those memories are seared into my brain.
Coxswains may be on the fence about calling themselves athletes, but the athletes rowing that boat might find it hard to get to the finish line without them. For Intern Edition, I'm Kate Brantley.
Yeah! Keep it going, Allie, for five more!
Who hasn't tried zombie walking to Michael Jackson's Thriller? Behind closed doors, I'll bet everyone's done it. Andrew Prince tells us about a fan who's thrown the door wide open and is sharing his love of Thriller with the entire world.
Terry Chastain remembers exactly where he was the first time he heard Thriller.
I walked into a disco club in Columbus, Ohio, and I heard this laugh. It would like pierce from every corner of the room, and I wonder, what in the world is this?
So he looked up at the huge floor-to-ceiling video screen.
And there's Michael and the zombies doing this Thriller routine, bigger than life, right there in front of me, and it just blew me away.
What blew him away were the dance moves. Chastain has been a dance instructor for almost 40 years. He could teach you almost every kind of dance, from ballroom to Latin, swing to salsa. But when he saw Michael's performance on the big screen, he wanted to learn the moves himself.
It took us 3.5 months just playing it over and over and then doing the routine and realizing how we turned the wrong direction or one thing or another.
Frame by painstaking frame, they pieced the dance together. It was then that Chastain realized he had something he could use in the classroom.
One and 2.3.
Chastain had been trying to come up with unique ways to get middle school students interested in ballroom and other more traditional types of dance.
And that was the year Hot in Here by Nelly was hot.
So he taught the kids hip-hop moves to Nelly's song, and they loved it. And when Chastain ran out of hip-hop moves to teach, he turned to something near and dear to his heart, Thriller.
The nice thing about this routine is none of them dance the same. Every single character has a different way of doing it, which makes it really fun. Let's face it, there's not a soul on this earth who doesn't hear that music and wants to dance to it. Even if you do the zombie walks, I mean, everybody knows those.
Thriller blasts in the background as Chastain's legion of zombie students writhe across the dance floor. And after the music stops, one student admits,
"When I tried to dance it, I almost cried because it was so fast."
For Intern Edition, I'm Andrew Prince.
You're listening to Intern Edition. This is Erin Marie Williams.
And I'm Sean Bowditch. Most people capture family vacations in still pictures, but some travelers have taken to recording their foreign adventures on film and audio tape, which they then turn into sound collages. Their work is now on a record label called Sublime Frequencies. Intern Edition's Mike Cosentino explains how the label introduces listeners to distant places.
In 1996, Robert Millis, a musician from Seattle, took a trip to Nepal. He did some Himalayan trekking, saw snake charmers, and praying monks. He also listened to the radio.
It's an interesting window into that moment in time and in a place you are.
That love inspired Millis to capture the sounds of his trip to Nepal. Back in the U.S., he met someone who shared his passion for radio, Alan Bishop. Bishop did some recording of his own in Morocco in the early 80s, using a dual radio cassette recorder to make edits of local radio stations. To him, radio broadcasts create a music of their own.
It's really an instrument, you know, and in a sense it's an electronic instrument and somewhat underrated these days.
The pair met others who also love travel, radio, and field recordings. The small collective began sharing material with one another, and it wasn't long before they started thinking of ways to share the sound with a broader audience. In 2003, Bishop formed a record label, Sublime Frequencies.
Nobody really there to take on the amount of material we wanted to get people to hear, so we just had to do it ourselves.
That material includes anything from traditional folk sounds, seeping in over shortwave signals, to Brazilian bossa nova ballads heard next to Javanese FM announcers. These sounds are put together in montages that take the listener on a journey to faraway destinations.
What is the music of my country?
Marcus Boone is an English professor at York University. He says listening to the label's music makes him feel like he's right there with the traveler.
I think it's actually finally a much more honest presentation of what the soundscape in a place like Jakarta actually is when you move across the radio dial.
But the music you hear in the streets or blaring from the cassette shops, it's all around you, you know, when you travel. And you learn more by hanging out with people on the streets and going to their homes and their shops and hearing what they hear. To us, these forms of music are just as important as the kinds that Smithsonian or others have ignored.
That's Mark Gerges. He's a longtime member of the collective and the son of an Iraqi immigrant in Detroit. His heritage inspired him to create his compilation for the label. Because he couldn't actually go to Iraq in 2005, he used music he bought in Syria and Germany to highlight chubi, a popular style of Iraqi folk music. But critics have raised ethical concerns about ownership of the recordings. Bishop stands by the label's work. He says it's more about the project as a whole than the individual pieces used.
It's more of a collage piece to promote an area of sound than it is for the benefit of an individual or an artist or a radio station.
The members of Sublime Frequencies hope their listeners take away a do-it-yourself message from the music. You could rely on experts to create an experience for you, or you can make your own journey of music, sounds, and culture. For Intern Edition, I'm Mike Cosentino.
An archaeological dig is a major production. There's the logistics of getting to the site, setting it up, preserving what's found, the list goes on. But what you might find surprising is that archaeologists rarely get down and dirty. As Intern Edition's Erin Marie Williams reports, in some remote regions, outsourcing the digging is a common practice.
Some of you can probably name one or two famous pre-human fossils.
Lucy, the really small caveman guy.
You may even know the species names.
Australopithecus afarensis.
Homo floresiensis.
But how many can name the people who dig those fossils out of the ground? If you're picturing an Indiana Jones type, toss that idea. Modern archaeologists don't actually do much of the grunt work, what the professionals call excavating. Dr. Sally McBrady is from the University of Connecticut. She's been digging in Kenya for more than 30 years. McBrady explains that archaeologists function a lot like circus ringmasters.
I spend most of my time administering the
field expedition and figuring out what everyone is supposed to do every day and providing food and, you know, medical supplies and everything. So it's a more of a logistical exercise than an excavation for myself.
When digs take place in the U.S. and Europe, students provide the necessary muscle. But when it comes to unearthing ancient fossils in places like Kenya, skilled workers are a necessity. Using students is problematic, both in terms of cost and experience. You really want a well-seasoned expert.
My name is Vincent Kinemache Kimem. I have worked here at Olixali for 21 years. This is the 22nd.
Kamoyu is a member of the Olorgesailie Research Project in southern Kenya. He's one of about 30 workers on the crew, many who have been here for more than 15 years. Kamoyu didn't get his job because of any special skills. When he joined, Kamoyu says he didn't know anything about archaeology, but he did know someone on the crew.
My stepbrother is the one who found me this job.
That's how things work here, how employers find reliable workers and workers find good jobs. Dr. Rick Potts is the director of the Olorgesailie Research Project. He says that another advantage of the system is the steady income it assures families, even across generations.
Well, the baby of the crew right now is Kiyoko Musioka, and he is the son of a member of crew who sadly passed away last year. The crew all recognized and recommended to me that his son would be a very good person to hire and keeping the continuity within the family.
Besides the benefit of family connections, crew members speak of job satisfaction. Francis Sina has been a part of the crew for 11 years.
I like it because it helps me learn many things. No way else would I have gotten a job like that one.
Excavators in Kenya help uncover some of humankind's earliest relatives. That appeals to many crew members, including Kamoyu.
Now the history here is available all over the world. We are proud.
And who wouldn't be? Very few of us will ever see, let alone touch, the fossils of our ancestors. But to these excavators, it's all in a day's work. For Intern Edition, this is Erin Marie Williams.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered from NPR News, but I'd rather be listening to Intern Edition. Why? Because coming up, radio recordings from distant lands become sound collages, and another kind of recording is used to uncover the mysteries of sexual attraction. As if that weren't enough, there's expanded content on the web, stories about having the stomach to be a street vendor in L.A., domestic violence, music reviews, and more.
For Intern Edition, I'm Sean Bowditch.
And I'm Erin Marie Williams. Dating is stressful, so why not get some professional help? That's the idea behind Companionships. It's a singles networking organization for Muslim Americans looking for a spouse. Asma Khalid takes us into the world of professional matchmaking.
At a Days Inn hotel in Alexandria, 40 singles mingle over dinner. At one table, a former Southern Baptist with a fiery red beard talks about how he once wanted to become a preacher. Nearby sits an engineer. She's the daughter of Indian immigrants. Her long, black, Bollywood-esque hair swoops over her gold hoop earrings. Across the room, an African-American woman wearing a headscarf chats with a man from Cuba. Although the diversity in the room is startling, attendees share a common thread. They're Muslim, and their tradition teaches that getting married is a large part of the faith. They've come tonight, during the holy month of Ramadan, to fulfill their religious duty, but also to see whether they'll find a match.
Well, I'm looking for, you know, a soulmate, but it's just so hard to meet people nowadays.
That's Hafsa Ghulam, the engineer. She never thought Muslim singles events would work, but she's beginning to change her mind. It's a Wednesday, and tonight she's battled rush hour traffic to get here. Her parents have been relentless about her finding a man.
Out of all of my siblings, there's four of us. They're all either married or engaged, and I'm the only one, so the pressure is really on now. They're like, you have to find a man, and, you know, my mom's always like, why don't you just go to India, go find a guy in India, and I'm like, no, you know, let's just try to stick to somebody here, it's just so much easier.
The night begins with a round of bingo, Islamic style, with questions like, what do you enjoy about Ramadan? Within a few minutes, it's time for the evening prayer. Religion plays a strong role in the program, as Imam Majid explains. He and his wife head the Companionships organization.
We teach in the program some aspect of the, what Islamic marriage look like. We use the Holy Quran, teaching that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and we explain the responsibility of husband and wife from Islam.
Imam Majid calls himself a matchmaker. He doesn't pair couples together, but he offers them this forum. A common sense of religious devotion brings most of these singles together. Well, that and the frustration of watching all your friends settle down.
This year I had several friends get married.
Bathsheba Philpa is in her mid-30s. She converted to Islam 10 years ago.
So I do sort of feel now, I'm getting asked questions like, when are you going to get married, and are you seeing somebody, and I'll ask my husband to look out for you. So I think there is certainly a certain level of pressure, because, you know, again, it's such a, a strong part of our faith.
Despite the social pressure, Bathsheba believes the Islamic setting simplifies the dating discussion.
Well, I think in some ways I think it's easier being a Muslim just because, you know, Islam stresses marriage. So I think you do find it being sort of, it's sort of ingrained in the culture of, I think, a lot of Muslims to, you know, search for marriage because it is such an important part of our faith.
As she closes the night, Amara, the imam's wife, offers a few words of encouragement.
Contact me. Say, Amara, I'd like you to follow up with this brother that I met here last night. Let me know and let me work for you. This is not a business that intends to keep you all as clients for a long time. Our business is about getting you off of our clientele list.
Within minutes, Hafsa gives Amara her email address. She thinks she may have met a special someone here tonight. This is Asma Khalid for Intern Edition.
Trying to attract a member of the opposite sex? The list of things to obsess about just got a little longer. You have to have the right clothes, a nice smile, shiny hair, and now we have to add voice pitch. Sean Bowditch tells us about a recent study that explores the relationship between voice and sexual attraction.
Yes or no? Would you marry this guy?
Ujambo.
How about this man? Sounds sexy and smart?
Ujambo.
Would this guy be a good dad?
Ujambo.
All important questions. But would you choose a mate based on something as simple as voice? That's what anthropologist Karen Apicella wanted to answer, so she flew halfway around the world to Tanzania and spent her summer studying the Hadza community. The Hadza people live simply. Women dig for tubers and pick berries, while men collect honey and hunt with traditional bows. Apicella was curious to see if voice pitch had any influence on mate preference, while acknowledging that it was just one in a matrix of factors. So, one by one, Apicella invited over 100 adults into her Land Rover and recorded them saying hello in Swahili. From there, she had the men and women listen to 8 voices each, 4 from the Hadza community.
Ujambo.
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 And 4 from Britain, like these.
When the sunlight strikes raindrops in the air,
they act as a prism and form a rainbow.
As Apicella explains, each person was asked to make a choice.
So I had the Hadza in different camps listen to these voices of the same individual, the higher-pitched voice one and lower-pitched voice one, and I just asked them, you know, which one do you prefer?
That is, who would they marry based on what they heard? Apicella found women preferred men with lower voices, and men favored women with higher-pitched voices.
And then I asked them some unusual questions, like, which woman do you think is a better gatherer, who collects the most food? And we found that the men actually thought the women with the lower-pitched voice or the deeper voices actually were better gatherers.
The same was true for women. A majority said men with deeper voices were better hunters. Apicella also discovered that lower-pitched men have more children than their squeaky, high-pitched counterparts. But she says the explanation for that might be more complicated.
It could be that these men have greater access to mates. And so maybe these men that have deeper voices have higher levels of testosterone. Maybe they're better hunters, and they're able to bring more food home to their wives.
All of this brings us to an even bigger question. Do these findings say anything about gender and relationships outside of Tanzania? We decided to test it out on a few of the many interns that take Washington, D.C. by storm each year. In a classroom in Adams Morgan, we asked several women to express a preference.
Ujambo. Ujambo.
Ujambo.
First reaction, which one of these gentlemen would you marry?
Probably the first one.
I mean, the first one, I guess.
The kind of funny-sounding one?
The first one.
Why?
Because he's smooth and
not aggressive.
It seemed less scary, the voice.
You know, the other guy seemed kind of drunk and old.
Well, the other two were sort of Ujumbo, and this one was Ujumbo, and I like that. Can I hear them again?
This sample is noticeably small, but it's worth mentioning that not one of those women chose the man with the lowest voice. Apparently in this crowd, falsetto is all the rage. For Intern Edition, I'm Sean Bowditch. Don't have to be rich to be my
listening to NPR's Intern Edition.
Our managing editor was Leah Scarpelli, and the executive producer was Gu Chisu.
This show wouldn't have happened without the following people. We learned how to do what we did from Laura Bertrand, Daniel Zwardling, Barbara Bradley Haggerty, Jonathan Kern, Evie Stone, Sora Newman.
A very special thanks to the mentors of Intern Edition, Netta Ulaby, Tashima Walker, Peter Overby, Margaret West, David Malikoff, Elizabeth Shogren, Jeffrey Fryman Wire, Libby Lewis, Rob Ballinger, Kevin Beasley, Martina Castro, Angie Lynn Hamilton Lowe, Ned Wharton, Stephen Thompson, Bob Boylan, Maeve McGoran, and Audrey Wynn.
The show sounds good thanks to Kevin Waite, John Widoff, Carlos Gomez, and Andy Rosenberg. From NPR West, our tech support comes from Carlos Asensio and Patrick Murray. The HR folks that paved the way, Claudine Robinson, Pam Dorsey.
Intern Edition advisor and our guiding light, Amy Blazik, and the guru of the Next Generation Radio Project, Doug Mitchell.
If we forgot your name, we still love you.
Learn more about our charity by visiting dcgreenworks.org. This episode of Intern Edition has been a carbon neutral program.
Like what you heard today? Log on to www.nprinternedition.org. There you'll find additional content, including a host audition mockumentary, reviews of our interns' favorite eats, and more.
Thank you for joining us today. I'm Sean Bowditch.
And I'm Erin Marie Williams for Intern Edition.